You're listening to the Author Stories Podcast, bringing you the story behind the stories and the storytellers.
Margaret Wise,
Terry Brooks,
Sheena Kamal,
Matthew Quick,
J.T. Ellison,
Walt D. Williams,
Brad Ford,
Corey Doctorow,
Brandon Sanderson,
Robin Mock,
Ernest Klein, Jim Butcher,
Sherilyn Harris.
Visit HankGarner.com for archives of all the shows. Today's guest is...
Joining me again for the Author Stories Podcast, where I bring you the story behind the stories and the storytellers. Today, I am super excited to have Jake Brown on the show with me today. Jake has a phenomenal new book. It's called Behind the Boards Nashville. And if you are a fan of music in general, you are going to absolutely love this book. Whether you like country music or not, or whether you've ever visited Nashville, or, you know, if you have any connection at all, that does not matter. You're going to absolutely love this book. Welcome to the show, Jake.
Thank you so much for having me on. I appreciate it.
I'm excited to have you, Jake. I've been looking through this book for the last couple of weeks, and the more I read, the more I just get more and more excited about it. So, but before we dig into all the great stuff that you've done, we begin each show with the same question. And that question is, what is your first memory of wanting to be a writer or storyteller?
Well, to be quite honest, as we were talking a little bit before we started, I grew up I play six instruments. I'm an ear player, but I grew up a musician. I studied classical music in high school by ear at the Washington Music Conservatory with Valerika Mikan and stuff. And I was also just obsessed with the record industry. I went to a Bon Jovi concert with my mom, Tina and Brown, and my Aunt Heather and my brother Josh when I was 11. And we got side stage seats, which were not good seats. These were seats that were like the last available ones because the slippery railway floor was blowing up. But And I volunteered to take like the worst seat in the house because I was mesmerized by all of the activity going on backstage, be it the roadies, the dress crew, the techs dealing with the different amplifiers and guitars, and just seeing how a show was put on. And I call it kind of my proverbial Ed Sullivan moment, where you hear like all these rock stars say, oh, I saw the Beatles and that's what I wanted to do. For me, it was more like I saw all of that behind the scenes going on. And that sparked my interest in working in the record business. And anyone that knew me growing up, like, that's all I talked about and that's all I wanted to do. And I read every periodical every week. Thank God my father, James Brown, would get me Rolling Stone every week. I ordered Metal Edge. I ordered, Metal Hammer. I ordered Rip. If you remember Rip, R.I.P.
Oh, yeah.
Parader. And I grew up in such an amazing decade in the 1980s. I'm 44, so my childhood was really 5 to 15 in 1980 to 90 in terms of really absorbing all of that amazing music going on MTV. And you had the triple exposure. Bear in mind, back then you had Casey Kasem's Top 40. And every week in that top 10, you would hear hip-hop, R&B, pop, hair metal, new wave, rap. It was all these amalgam of genres being mixed. And then when you'd see the visual sort of impression that made on you with the videos. But there was also books by guys like Danny Sugarman and others. And there wasn't a lot of them. Music biographers, this is what I went on to do, is a really specialized niche. But at the time there were not, there was no internet, there was nothing like that. So you really got your input from either magazine interviews, occasional MTV interviews, but mostly from these books. And there were books like Hitmen, Mansion on the Hill, that would tell like the 1970s story of Asylum and David Geffen and some of these other amazing Irving Azoff and, Clive Davis and Mo Austin. I worked for Geffen very briefly before I left Los Angeles, and I actually got to meet Mo Austin and tell him what a hero of mine he was. And he kind of looked at me weirdly. He's like, dude, I'm a fat record executive. I'm like, I don't understand, man. So it basically, through my high school years, I had just been kind of an amateur study of record labels and at the same time playing in bands. And so I had no ambition to be a writer. It just was the other creative skill I had along with music when I was like an idiot in math and science and all that stuff. So I got into college, and the long story short is ADD back then, a creative ADD, was not diagnosed yet in the early 90s and mid 90s. So I got basically slated, rather than to take these awful tests, they let me write papers for like the last 2 years of school. So I mean, I must have written 200 different papers and long form kind of. So my point is, I kind of, without realizing it, was getting training a little bit in doing chapter length kind of papers. Long story short, I moved to Los Angeles. right out of college with my futon, my cat, my guitar, and my drum set. I was working for a label called Cleopatra Records. I met this literary agent named Marcy Northrup, who was a publicist as well and became my first agent. And as I was telling you, on a bet from her, she said, you know, you're really pretty, you're okay at writing this copy and these press releases. Have you ever thought about writing a book? And she had a client at the time, I'm not going to mention out of respect for them, but that she thought, you know, I need a writer for this book. And I didn't really want to, I wasn't like a big fan of theirs, and I was really didn't want to like launch a writing career on that. But I sort of viewed book writing as sort of, this could be an interesting side thing along with producing. And I took her up on it, but I said, look, I'd really love to write a book on Suge Knight, who, as we talked about, was just getting out of prison. And I was a huge Dr. Dre fan growing up. He was such a huge influence on me. And without Suge, he wouldn't have gotten released from Ruthless, and we wouldn't have The Chronic. We wouldn't have Snoop. We wouldn't have Snoop Dogg. We wouldn't have Tupac. He got Tupac out of prison for those 8 months, and he made those 300 songs with Johnny J. We wouldn't have all these things at the same time that Suge used these mob tactics that white record people like Morris Levy had done for years with Roulette Records and others to keep black artists, you know, really in slave contracts. And he flipped that script and opened doors that without him, you wouldn't have had Bad Boys Deal for Sean Combs. You wouldn't have had Master P. You wouldn't have Cash Money. You wouldn't have had Rockefeller with Jay-Z. It's just irrefutable. So it goes on and on. At the same time, he was a notorious figure, and obviously I thought that would make for interesting reading. And that book came out in real time with his prison release. A publisher named Amber Books, Tony Rose, gave me my start in the business, him and his wife Yvonne. And that book immediately blew up. It blew me away. I thought maybe 1,000 people would read it, but it sold thousands of copies, and it was paperback, mass market. So back then, there weren't really ebooks. So it was kind of more, it was better for an author because mass market paperbacks, if you remember in the 80s, like even Stephen King books, they'd be in those, I'm not comparing myself, but I'm saying the same format. They'd be in tiny print. They were cheap to produce and they went out everywhere. So all of a sudden, I had you want to do another one? And that's one of the biggest lessons I impart. Over 50 books in 20 years, I've had a lot of like kids that grew up reading my stuff that email me and they're like, hey, what, I want to be a writer. How do I get into it? And I tell them, take any gig you can get when you're starting out. It's the same with a sound engineer in this book, Behind the Boards Nashville. The producers started out, they took on gigs that, as engineers, they might never have desired to record, but you get so much experience from it. And it also tells people that, that are in the control of these things, like, producers, studio owners, et cetera, and the same time publishers, that you're willing as a young writer to take on, projects they might bring you. Literary agents, if they're worth their salt, are going to bring you projects sometimes too, because that, like as an example that Marcy had when I started. So the second book I did as an example was R. Kelly. I hate R. Kelly. I thought he was a sexual predator back then. And if you read that book, I indict him as such. And that's back in 2004. Doubleday licensed that book and made me rewrite the foreword so that it was less harsh on him. But but my point is, that was book number two. Book number three was Jasmine St. Clair. It was an adult film star. And that was called What the Hell Was I Thinking? And I thought, this is just early in my career. I was taking on whatever I could because at the same time, I was producing. I had a distribution deal through Big Daddy Music. And then it was kind of making records and was like, this is an interesting sideline. But as time went on, I kept writing these hip hop books through like 2004 or 5. It was one on 50 Cent, one on Biggie Smalls, one on Jay-Z. And then I had an idea as I had moved to Nashville in 2003 after living in New York 5 years. I thought, let's see if I can launch this series called Behind the Boards. And it was going to interview rock producers. And the first two volumes of the book, which I have right here for reference so I can remember all the names, basically wound up becoming, there was another series called Behind the Glass, but that was it. And so by Howard Massey, and I grew up reading him too. So it was kind of cool to carry that mantle on. And I mean, in that first book I had, Bob Ezrin from Pink Floyd, Jack Douglas, Bones Howe. My God, I grew up so hardcore on the 70s Tom Waits catalog from Asylum. Mario C. from the Beastie Boys, Butch Vig, Linda Perry, Scott Humphrey, Hugh Padgham, who did Genesis and Phil Collins in the Air Tonight, Bob Rock, Don Was. I'm just giving you some examples. Don Gaiman, who did the Mellencamp stuff. Jay Maskus from Dinosaur Jr. Keith Olsen, who did Jesse's Girl. Ron Nevison, that did Heart. Michael Beinhorn, that did the Chili Peppers. And Dave Jordan. And these guys are all my heroes. Dave Jordan, that did Jane's Addiction. And it just went on. So that kind of showed me that there was a market for and an underserved market for interviewing people behind the scenes that I was already a lot of really working with. And so I just started reaching out to producers I knew, and then others I didn't, but that I was able to reach. And before I knew it, I had like 30 of them. So it split up over two books. Volume two was guys like, I'm just going to go through a couple of these. Bill Simswick that did the Eagles, Ken Scott that did, you know, Rocket Man, Jim Gaines that did Stevie Ray Vaughan, Mike Shipley that worked with Mutt Lang and all that Def Leppard stuff, you know, Frankie Sullivan, The Eye of the Tiger. So it just went, you know, on and on and on. And I thought, wow, okay. So those two books were the start of that. And then I brought that same publisher that did the rap books, this idea for Tupac in the studio. And the In the Studio brand, I've had such dumb luck in my career with brands, and branding is vital as an author if you want to have a longevity. So sure. I brand out series. Like I have a trademark now after 15 books on the In the Studio name. You'd never think that someone else didn't have that. They didn't. Behind the Boards, no one had. I write a signature series here called Nashville Songwriter, which we can get to later, that profiles all of the hit writers on Music Row, all the number one writers. It's the definitive series. No one had that, dumb luck. So In the Studio was launched with Afeni Shakur, Tupac's mother, who had turned down about 90% of the books. My lawyer at the time was Dina LaPolt. And that's another important thing. If you're an author, you've got to have a great agent. You've got to have a great lawyer. You've got to have, you know, people, surround yourself with good people young, because you can sign yourself into really bad long-term contracts that a book might sell well, but screw you out of a lot of royalty revenues and ancillaries, like, you know, overseas foreign rights. You might get a 10% of a $2,000 or $3,000 advance when you should be getting 40%, stuff like that. So she also represented the Shakur estate. And I took this idea to her. She took it to Afeni. Afeni actually signed off on it, which blew me away. And that opened the door for me to interview Johnny J. First and only book interview he ever did before he died that detailed the entire making of that Death Row catalog. I talked to Big Syke from Thug Life. Both those guys have passed away since. So it shows you these books. And so it was occurring to me as I was doing this in the first decade of the millennium that these books, the way I was writing them, were designed in part to entertain the fan that was like more of a, you know, just they want to read about how these songs were made. But they were also for the academic side of people that want to become record producers themselves, almost as reference guides. And that was really amplified and hit home to me. In 2018, Dave Cobb, the great Dave Cobb, was one of the first guys to sign on to the country volume of Behind the Boards. And he told me he had Rick Rubin. I did a Rick Rubin In the Studio book later in the millennium. He said, man, that's on my shelf in my studio. I use it as a reference for like how he mic'd drums and stuff. So earlier on, it occurred to me that it could be a niche to sort of write books that balanced telling fans the behind the scenes stories of how these artists worked in the studio, while at the same time providing kind of sort of a source or a reference guide or an archive, if you will, of these amazing producers and how they made these records organically. And if you think about digital millennium record making, there's so many people that make records now with samples. They don't even know how to mic a live drum set. They don't know what an RE20 is, which is a common kick drum mic. They don't know what top and bottom miking a snare is. They don't know what overhead mics are and the relationship of them to a sound a drum set gets. They don't know what room mics are. They don't know, you know. So between these books and I'm sure a lot of other sources, I'm not trying to give them too much credit, but I'm told quite often that, you know, SAE here in Nashville has four of them in their library. So my point is, I found a niche. I worked really, 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 really hard, obviously, because if you're not going to do that, don't try. Some people get this romantic notion that book publishing is like, oh, I'll do one book and every 5 years I'll do another one. And that's reserved for people like David Ritz, you know what I mean? Or something.
Right.
So my point is, I just, fortunately, my mind never stops creatively kind of going. And so I just put that into a lot of different opportunities that came my way. Through that Jasmine St. Clair book, I interviewed Lemmy Kilmister from Motorhead. And I had already had the fortune to back up a second, and I'll shut up in a minute. I'm just giving you some backdrop. Anna Nancy Wilson from Heart. I grew up so hugely a Heart fan, like so many did. And especially in the 1980s, I had, you know, if you grew up in the 80s, you not only had those charts I talked about before and your input from MTV, you were also getting record, tape, and CD. So you could just ensconce yourself in music and just bury yourself in it and really still go about your life. But it became such that I thought, man, what if I could do it in the studio book? Because after the Tupac book did well, I thought, let me see if I could do a book on Heart, because I was desperate to break out of writing just in hip hop. And so I went around and actually took a big gamble and emailed and interviewed all of the members of Heart's former lineups, their producers. Wow. I knew some of the producers from the Beyond the Behind the Boards books, but I did all that first. Then Howard Leese gave me Ann Wilson's email, and I decided to just email her. And I got a really pissed call from their manager like a couple days later, and I thought, oh, well, that's the end of that deal. And I was figuring she was getting ready to say, you know, we're going to sue you and all this. And instead, she was very sweet, very nice lady. And she said, well, let me go ahead and get you interviews. When I told her about the idea, she said, all right, well, I need to get you interviews with the girls. And I was like, huh? And she said, yeah, let me go ahead and get you an interview. Ann didn't think this was a bad idea. And Nancy likes to talk about. So next thing I knew, I was writing a book with those two. And I went, and when they authorized it, and that's another really important thing. I did some books early in my career that were what you'd call unauthorized because I had to, because to get a foot in the door. But I never used unnamed sources. I don't believe in that. I think it's a cheap shot way to write about people. And, you know, with the Heart book, to have that 100% authorized stamp was amazing. And then a company named ECW Press out of Canada picked that book up on the condition that Heart would authorize a selling it at shows, which piqued my interest. Oh, wow, I never thought about that. There's another way you can sell books. With QR codes, now it's more common in these 360 deals because there's so much less money in record sales because of streaming. But at the time, it was sort of a new thing. So I was just kind of riding with it, man. And then I met Lemmy through that Jasmine book. I took the Heart book and I cold called him and pitched him on in the studio. And he said, yeah, I sent him a copy. He said, let's do it. Next thing I know, I'm writing a book with Lemmy Kilmister. So that was like another big, huge kind of boost for me. And at the time, all of the Walmart stopped carrying CDs. So my distribution deal, while I still had it, took a real hit. And writing actually then became a matter of necessity. So I think I moved to Nashville with two published books, and 18 years later, we're at 50, because I just kind of ran with it, you know, from that point, because I had to make a living. And got very lucky with some other, you know, books through ECW. I did a Rick Rubin in the Studio book, which Rick okayed, but didn't really want to do interviews for, but I interviewed a lot of his engineers. And that's, again, the only book on Rick Rubin out there. I've been lucky with that. I've been lucky that I've had certain artists that I've either written with or about, but with their okay, that have wound up being like the book that's on them. And in every case, they're really the only studio books. And I really, another thing that I did and I recommend to authors is find your niche. When you brand out series like in the studio, that's a brand of mine, but I can write under that brand with any style I want. So there's books in that series on AC/DC, Tori Amos, Dr. Dre, Tom Waits. I'm mentioning some of the others besides these, AC/DC and Iron Maiden. When I sold the book to Lemmy Kilmister, the Motorhead in the Studio book, to this publisher in London called John Blake, that introduced me too to another concept. Wow, English-speaking territories for these bands that have global followings will publish that book in all of them. So you don't have to limit yourself to a North American publisher. That also opened me up to the UK reading audience, and I've been fortunate to have a pretty good following over there too. They then came back to me and said, would you be interested in doing an Iron Maiden in the Studio in AC/DC? And I said, yeah, as long as I keep my trademark on in the studio part, absolutely. Well, there, boom, there was two more books. So it just kind of took on this weird thing. And then the challenge was, you know, you have to just write them. And I work 7 days a week, 20 hours a day to this day, maybe not 20 hours anymore. I mean, I did in the spring. I wrote that Behind the Boards Nashville in 3 months. But normally I work all the time, and if you stay that committed, you're just going to wind up becoming prolific. And then fortunately, I've had the blessing of a lot of publishers that, as my name continued to kind of gain, I guess, readership. I hate that whole kind of, I'm just saying that kind of following gives you a career. And then when you have a career, you've got to keep feeding it, because if you don't, there are 100 or 1,000 writers per day waiting to take your place. You know what I mean? So it becomes, and I also did a lot of important things back in the first decade of the millennium when I was building my name up as a writer. I went and networked my ass off. I went to like every BEA. I did all those stupid industry signings, but you're signing books not because anyone really knows you as a reader, but a lot of industry people want these signed books from like retailers, Barnes & Noble's regional buyer for the Midwest, Barnes & Noble's regional buyer for the West Coast, Books a Million. So you're getting this incredible opportunity basically for free because your publisher pays for your pass to walk around the floor and pitch yourself. And I literally would walk every row and meet every single publisher and pitch them every single time. And maybe one out of 100 would wind up becoming, you know, interested. And that's how I sold Behind the Boards, because it wasn't until 2011 that I sold that series to Hal Leonard. And then they picked up both of these books. And by then they were finished manuscripts just waiting to go out. So that's kind of a little, that's the first 10 years. I can tell you about the second 10 years, but I'll shut up so you can talk a little bit. But that's kind of the backdrop.
Want to grow as a writer and take your writing to the next level? Give Pro Writing Aid a try. Pro Writing Aid is a grammar checker, style editor, and writing mentor in one package. Pro Writing Aid will never replace a human editor. Rather, it helps you self-edit to a deeper level so that when you send it off to an editor, they will be able to focus on the meat of your writing and not spend their time fixing basic writing issues. Pro Writing Aid is the only platform that offers world-class grammar and style checking, combined with more in-depth reports to help you strengthen your writing. Our unique combination of suggestions, articles, videos, and quizzes makes writing fun and interactive. Writing can be grammatically perfect, but still feel awkward and clumsy. Pro Writing Aid searches out elements like repetitiveness, vague wording, sentence length variation, over-dependence on adverbs, passive voice, overcomplicated sentence structures, and so much more. Nothing makes a writer lose credibility faster than spelling and grammar mistakes. Submit clean, error-free writing. Go to ProWritingAid.com and use code HANK20 for 20% off of Pro Writing Aid Premium. Pro Writing Aid. Check it out today. Noveler is the best way to write a novel. Why? Quite simply because we've made it the easiest place to do it. Writing a novel is hard enough. Noveler takes care of all the logistical bits of writing a novel, just leaving that small matter of the words to you. It's a clean, beautiful writing interface with writing analytics, goals and streaks, advanced grammar checking, version control, day, evening, and night modes, and many other features designed to take all the stress out of writing. Tell us what you need and we'll build it. Together, we'll build a better tool. With a design-led approach, all the right tools that you need, Noveler saves all your words constantly, allows you to manage and order your novel easily. It's accessible from any device, desktop or mobile. It syncs to Google Drive and Dropbox. It allows exports in various formats, including ebook and more. It also has nice touches like allowing you to write both offline and online, unique for a web-based platform. Everyone needs help with their writing from inspiration through to grammar checking, so we're doing our best to provide that support. We integrate that support directly into Noveler. Our advanced grammar checker powered by Pro Writing Aid does everything from spell check to style advice. Our writing courses include the incredible Tim Clare's Couch to ADK. We're really excited to offer all Author Stories listeners 30% off Noveler for a whole year. And it doesn't matter if you choose to sign up for the monthly or annual plan, you'll get 30% off. All you need to do is use the discount code HANK when you sign up. Noveler, N-O-V-L-R. That's Noveler.org.
Let me ask you this, Jake, as you kind of formed this niche in the industry that and kind of became known as kind of a biographer or biographers,
a music biographer.
How do you start earning people's trust to get gigs like this? Because, you know, I understand that, you know, in the beginning you kind of find a topic and you write about it, but there, you know, you have all these great stories of people that you've met and that you have earned their trust, and you get a great glimpse behind the fact, you know, looking through this book, Behind the Boards Nashville, just reading through here. I mean, there are, you know, speaking of Dave Cobb that you mentioned earlier, you know, the second chapter of the book is about Dave. And, you know, there's this great back and forth, you know, between the two of you. And there's obviously a rapport there. You know, the first chapter with Dan Huff, you know, I remember Dan's first album that he put out with his band Giant
way
back in the day. See You in My Dreams, you know, and now he's, you know, everyone has heard Dan Huff over and over again every single day, whether they know it or not, and probably they don't. But he's one of the most recognizable names. But when you read, you know, through his chapter, it's a great back and forth between you and him. Yes, he gives great technical, you know, information and stuff about what he does, but there's an obvious rapport there. How do you earn that with people, especially when you work with so many people?
Well, I can kind of more bullet point that, I guess, because I've talked about it enough now. You don't really think about process until you promote and then people ask you about it because you're too busy doing it, but it's a fair question. Trust is one of the most uncommon commodities in the record business. And I have for a very, 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 for 20 years, I have been lucky because I give my word to these record producers. All while I was writing those rap books, I was also interviewing all of these record producers for like years and years and years. And I gave them my word that, first of all, it wouldn't be a fluff piece where it's, you know, like, you know, it would basically be more of a situation where we talked for 5 or 6 hours. I mean, and it extended to these country guys too. Dave Cobb and I talked, you know, once, and we talked again. Then we had a third conversation earlier in this year about Star Is Born and some of his more recent hits. But I basically give them my word that these books are going to be like about them and that it's going to tell their full story. We tell the backstory in every one of these producers' cases. You don't just know about their records and their stars they work with. You know about when they were born, what kind of music they grew up on, when they first discovered songwriting, what bands they were in, their hard road to Nashville, the trials and tribulations, the struggles, the firings from record labels and they lost their deals or publishing deals, the songwriters, records they made that didn't sell. And almost invariably, every single one of them has that same theme in some form or manner. And I had that. I went through that myself, you know, as a record producer, as a musician, as a songwriter. It took me 18 years to get my publishing deal with Streets Music in London and David Gershom in South Africa. And I got 200 songs in my catalog. But I'm just saying, like, it's not an easy business. And so because I'm a musician as well, and because I spent about half my week in a studio the last 20 years. I mean, I moved to Nashville expressly for that purpose so I could work full time in the business and not have to worry about, you know, the retarded rents in New York or LA. And so you just meet people and a lot of the relationships that I developed to write these books started out more out of either they met me through another book and then I would go back to them and say, hey, by the way, I write this other series. Is it a possibility you'd be willing to talk to me more elaborately about your broader catalog? Because we might have just focused on one artist they work with. And the other thing, I never use anonymous sources. I think that is such a – I don't want to cuss on your show, but it's such a cheap shot way to write. And it got – you know, people got away with it for a long time. And I took real issue with it. And as a writer, I really made it a point to advertise myself as someone that wouldn't do that. And that's important because, you know – when you work with a band like Heart, you're being vetted by like a lot of people. You're being vetted by their lawyers. You're being vetted by their managers. There's manuscripts being gone through with a fine tooth comb. Same with every book I do. Every producer in this book either had the opportunity or went through with me. Nathan Chapman and I spent like 4 hours on the phone one night going over his chapter line by line to make sure he was happy with it. Paul Worley spent a large amount of time doing little revisions to some of his quote, you know, commentary sections because he wanted to sort of retweak stuff. So I guess that is part of why, because I give people the opportunity to go back and look at their chapters and tell me what they don't like, tell me what they missed, or, hey, I forgot this one story, or, you know, that one, they might be working with a group again they hadn't worked with for 10 years and they don't want me to include, you know, this or that little thing. And the other thing I do is I focused as a theme from very early on in my career in only writing about music. And there's enough excitement within that realm to not have to talk about who was sleeping with who and what drugs people did and all that kind of crap. And I think leaving that out of it opened a lot more space up for people to feel comfortable talking to me. You know, the other thing that's important, I think, within that aspect of trust that you mentioned is I write for a lot of publishers. I didn't, you know, I've written for, I think it's like 20 publishers over the course of all that time. And because a lot of these get licensed overseas in, you know, Europe or in Japan. I've had very good fortune there. go Mr. Hot Tory in the English agency. But they sold two of my recent books, Prince in the Studio and Beyond the Beats, which is a rock drummer's anthology there. But I guess so. Anyway, a lot of it just has to do with getting in touch with the artists. You know, I had the – after the Motorhead and Heart book, I had the great fortune to write with Joe Satriani to write his memoir, Strange, Beautiful Music. And it was a musical memoir. And the important significance of that is that originally we were going to be doing it in the studio book. And it just morphed into something bigger because it took us two – you know, we wrote it for 3 years together before it came out. And, you know, that guy's a rocket scientist. I mean, sitting there talking to him, you feel like an idiot. And I'm not a guitar – I mean, I'm a guitar player, but nothing near his level. So – but the pitch that I made to him on that book was I did not feel that there had ever been really an appropriate – study of his science as a guitar player. Because he's, you know, him and Eddie Van Halen are like the two best. There's just no one like them, period. You can't right. debate it. It's not even a debatable fact. Those guys are the best in the world. I mean, there's lots of brilliant guitar players, but those two are kind of the bookends of greatness. And, you know, the G3 tour and Steve I. And, you know, bear in mind, Joe Satriani was a guitar teacher to guys like Kurt Hammett from Metallica and, you know, and Primus's guitar player and Steve I, who was his high school. So that opened the door to me then, you know, when we got the green light to do that book. Mick Brigden, Joe's manager, amazing manager. And that's another thing. When you work with these artists, you really have to take advantage of their network because managers are amazing as resources. They usually know somebody who can get to the person you want to interview. And we had the privilege of having Steve I in the book and, you know, Brian May wrote the foreword. It just became this amazing experience. And then when the book came out, Sony's publicist was behind it. And I had never used a publicist on a book before because it's a pretty expensive proposition. And I like to joke that publishers' publicists, no disrespect meant, but they're like a social worker with like 30 cases on their desk because they have so many books they're pushing at once. They can only give your book so much attention. So as an author, that's another lesson I learned. You've got to invest in yourself. So I spend about – I mean this book, I spent a pretty good amount of money with Samantha Downey, wonderful publicist and Dead Horse Branding but Joe's publicist, and then we had the label's publicist. We had this amazing team, and that book just blew up, man. It became a bestseller, and I mean, it had, it was on Arsenio Hall. It was on. I mean, suddenly I found myself, I'd be happy with just the rock press, but here we're in CBS News and Hollywood Reporter and all of these Rolling Stone and all this kind of stuff that elevated my name as a writer. And then Joe was the most gracious person I think I've ever written with, because in every interview he did, these were his interviews. My name was just in these articles. He would talk, you know, they'd ask him, what was it like writing the book with Jake? And he would spend like, man, you know, two or three paragraphs talking about it. And then he took a whole page and a half in the front of the book and credited me with the idea for it and thanked me for the, it was amazing. I don't have enough words, but it was never lost on me that I would have been happy just with my name on the cover along with his, you know what I mean? But right. So that when you mentioned trust, I guess I'm saying those things must be a reflection of a certain element of trust. And then we got back together in 2017 and we updated the book for paperback. And he's telling me about the G3 tour going through Russia and Scandinavia and Israel and Japan and China and all these countries where all these fans are coming up to him with this book. And when you write books, you know, you know, social media can give you some impression of how many people read them, but you really don't know. It's really a weird business because you're not like a musician that's out there touring where you get to interact with your reading audience. So it was really rewarding to know that that book had touched his fan base that globally. But it's also important in marketing, and I make this point to people when I get asked this stuff, is, you know, as a writer, a lot of people think book writing's like burying yourself in a romantic little cocoon and that the rest of it will take care of itself. And it's just not true. You have to think about the marketing of a book from the time you sit down to start it and not think that that's an unromantic part of the process. I use that word because writing is romanticized a lot of times in people's minds, and that gets in their way of actually getting it out. Because first of all, a publisher is only going to be interested in putting a book out if they see that there's a proposal that clearly demonstrates to them where the marketplace is for it, which in a band's case is the fan base, how you're going to promote it, what you're going to be doing to let people know about it, you know, from social media standpoint, from a press standpoint. Is the book going to be sold on tour? Is there going to be inclusion in interviews relative to, say, a record it's being released with that it's being promoted through? So you've got to think of those things ahead of time, or else no one's going to read it. And the whole function of – I used to joke, like, Eddie Vedder in high school, I was a Pearl Jam fan, but Eddie Vedder would bitch and moan about, you know, oh, the commerciality of promotion. And then 10 years later, when Pearl Jam was kind of just a catalog band and they weren't making hits anymore, but they were still had their arena fans and stuff, they did a little USA Today story, and Eddie Vedder was just thanking them profusely for the coverage. And I thought, well, that worm's, you know, turn. but my point is, like, thinking of – you have to think of the commerciality of your book when you're writing it, or you'll never get it published, just period. And the other thing that's really important is – a publisher that sees they have a team player and an author that's going to be willing to put their own money into their own publicist to make sure you're reaching every corner of a potential reading audience is going to be more willing to work with you a second time. And you might have a really out-of-the-box idea that, you know, I've had several of that you want to take to them. And I'll give you a great example. When Ben Bella Books, Glenn Yefeth, who's the publisher over there, amazing guys, they do Geno Wickman series, and they've had a lot of million sellers, but certainly not this one, but this one sold very well for them. But I had just started kind of being interested in writing in country, because I went from being a hip hop writer for the first 5 years to then being a rock writer through like 2011. And then when I started working with Joe, I said, you know, I've lived here 10 years. I really haven't delved into country. I would love to write about the songwriters. And the idea came to me one day when I was getting a tire changed, and they had, you know, the TV on, the little lobby where you sit. And right. If you look back, you know, having grown up on MTV, you probably remember, because a lot of kids now don't know what a music video is. But back then, there was the music video credits would always say artist, song, label, director. They never, ever, ever, though, accredited the songwriter. But when country music's videos play, it says artist, you know, label, title, album title, label name, and then it says songwriter. And I thought, that blew me away. I thought, wow. And then I started doing some research, and there was just no books out on this. There was a Chicken Soup for the Soul kind of fluff piece, you know, half a page maybe blurb oriented. And that's great. It's a brilliant style for people to quickly read through about little stories behind songs. And then I started doing some more research, and it's not a common known fact. It's getting more known now that about 80% of the songs that become number ones in country, say by Tim McGraw or by, you know, Dolly Parton's an exception because she writes her own songs, but most country stars do not write their own hits. And then I thought, well, how the heck is this done? And by that time, I'd gotten an office down on Music Row. And I started kind of, you know, seeing, wow, there's all these houses down here where inside these houses, songwriters sit in music publisher rooms all day long that all they do is write country hits. They write songs that hope they become cuts and then some become hits. But it's a machine. And there's two number one charts in country. So the demands on these people is insane because they have to keep banging out number one hits. And then, you know, I started kind of reaching out to some of them. And because by then I built up enough of a name in the kind of pedigree of these in the studio and behind the boards, and sort of you tell the personal story, but you also tell the story behind the records and the hits and how they were made. I thought, let's do one on how they're written. And it amazed me because they came out of the woodwork. And, you know, so the first book had, God, we had, you know, Willie Nelson and Merle Haggard did a chapter with Freddie Powers. He had Parkinson's by then. But that was such an honor to have those guys in the book. John Rich gave me like a foreword with songwriting tips. And then we had all these amazing songwriters, you know, like Whisperin' Bill Anderson and Craig Wiseman and Sonny Curtis, who wrote I Fought the Law. And I could go on and on. And that, you know, they're like really the unsung heroes of Nashville. And in the course of that book, I then did a second volume in 2018. And by then there was what's called Track Guys. Track Guys is an advent and a sort of product of the digital advent where in the olden days of country record production, it's still today somewhat the case, but not as much. You would have a session band. These session players would go in, and the best session players in the world live here. They would go into a studio and in an afternoon or a morning session, bang out three or four number one hits, the instrumental track four, period, done. And they go to the next session and they bang out another four. By the end of the day, they might have played on 12 number one songs or 12 cuts even, that then some of them became hits. And I thought, wow, what a machine. So if you think about the duality of the fact that you have on the one hand, these songwriters cranking out these songs that then get delivered to song pluggers, the song pluggers take them to managers, managers take them to the artist. The artist says, yes, I want to cut this. They do what's called putting a hold on it. And then that song gets cut. Then the label takes it and they go, well, we think this is a hit. We think that's a hit. We don't like this. And there's great stories in this book, as there are in the Nashville Songwriter books, about songs that became huge phenomenons that at first were battles. They got put on hold by three or four artists, which means Tim McGraw wanted it. Then it bounced over to Blake Shelton. Then it bounced over to this guy. Then it finally got to Luke Bryan, and Luke Bryan made it a hit. Thomas Rhett is a great example of that. There's a number of Thomas Rhett hits that were like Red Akins wrote, and it was his dad, and they were kind of bouncing around and wound up with him after a few years. And then, boom, he made it a number one. So it just amazed me that this behind this sort of scenes machine was at work, and it had not been chronicled in books. So proudly, I couldn't believe the dumb luck that no one had National Songwriter as a title. So I grabbed it, trademarked it, sold it. And the way I got that deal was the Satriani book, that publisher really wanted that book. And I was kind of, we had a couple others interested. And I said, look, I can probably, you know, I think we really want to go with you guys, but I have this other book, right? And I'm interested in launching it as a series. Would you be interested in it? And contingent on the Satriani sale, the National Songwriter book got sold as well. Mick and Joe had a really good vibe with Glenn Yeffeth, and he did an amazing job for them. So, I mean, it worked out. But that's how that kind of stuff works. You've got to network all the time if you're an author. You can't just sit in your house or your office and write and think an agent's going to do all the work for you. So that's kind of how the trust factor gets built out. It's not just with the artists or the songwriters or the producers you write with. You've got to be willing to write their full stories. You've got to give them not just 10 pages, but 30 pages. There's some chapters in this book, like Tony Brown's chapter. He produced George Strait, 40 number ones, plus number ones on George Strait, and Vince Gill and Reba McEntire. These got 120 number ones in total. That chapter is 45 pages long. And I made that deal with him that I would tell his full story and then go through his whole catalog. And the better you sell as an author, the more you can negotiate for what's called word count expansion, which means most publishers don't like to do a book that's over, say, 50,000 to 60,000 words, which is 250 to 300 pages, because it costs more per page to print it out. But you've got to explain to them that they're going to sell more books in the long run for that extra money they spend up front for the extra 100 pages, because that's 100 more hits. You know what I mean? And then the other cornerstone of this book series, as with National Songwriter, is you've got your academics who are like your aspiring producers, writers that want to read about these stories and inspire them to maybe come to town and then give them great tips and advice on how they, you know, get their foot in the door. You've also got just country fans that just like, hey, man, I'd love to read about how, you know, they got that great drum or guitar sound on this song or that song, or they love Live Like You Were Dying by Tim McGraw, and they can listen while they stream along. They can read about how these hits were made. So the other aspect of these books that I really tried hard to do. I mean, there's over 300 number ones in this book. The Nashville Songwriter, the first two books have 60 writers and probably 500 number ones. The third book's coming out next year. It's got another 30 writers and another, I don't know how many hundred number ones. But the importance is that you can also market to all of those fan bases of all those artists. Because in this book, if you want to know from Kenny Chesney, Tim McGraw, Luke Bryan, Carrie Underwood, Dolly Parton, Casey Musgraves. I mean, I could give you a litany of Lady Ella Antebellum, or I guess Lady A now. All their producers are in these books. Every single big country artist is in this book. Their producers are. So Byron Gallimore, and that was another interesting thread I discovered. Tim McGraw and Byron Gallimore, you mentioned trust. They've worked together 25 years, man. That's unheard of in any other genre of music, period. I've written in all of them. It's just not done. Producers typically work with an artist for one or two, three records tops. So to see the longevity, it was a common thread that ran through this book. Tim McGraw and Byron Gallimore, Michael Knox and Jason Aldean, that's 15 years. I'm just going to give you a few examples. Luke Bryan and Jeff Stevens is 15 years. Miranda Lambert and Frank Lydell, Brad Paisley and Frank Rogers. So it was really fascinating to me. Kenny Chesney and Buddy Cannon. It was just fascinating to me to see these long-term trust relationships that build up between an artist and producer. And then a lot of these guys become co-producers. I interviewed Vince Gill yesterday morning for the third Nashville book. He started out with Tony Brown and then went out on his own. Clint Black is in this book. Clint Black started out with James Stroud, who's the best of the best. And after a couple records, James Drouth said, buddy, you're ready to go out on your own and do this. And, you know, there's this really cool learning curve where you get through these chapters to see how a lot of these amazing country stars became amazing country stars, and how they learned how to be recording artists, and how they learned how to tell the producer what was in their head, and how they wanted it to get onto tape. And just, I'm so lucky because a lot of these people were willing to talk to me. There'd never been a definitive volume of country music producers put in one book before where you got their full backstories. And there's really a lot of magic too here with session players. Boy, if you want to get an education on the 80s and 70s of country, it's in here too, because guys like Dan Huff that you mentioned, Paul Worley, others, Frank Rogers, others that were guitar players on a lot of country hits. Josh Leo that went on to produce Alabama and Nitty Gritty Band, others. They started out behind on the other side of the board, out in the live room, and they learned the process of record making through being players. And then Dan Huff, when he was working with Mutt Lange said, you're ready to do this, and kind of give him the nudge to go and go out and start off with Keith Urban. And we started out with Megadeth, actually, right? And then went to Keith Urban. And when Dan Huff and Keith Urban started working together, Keith Urban had one record out. So there's another relationship I should mention of longevity. Keith Urban and Dan Huff have made records for 20 years. Taylor Swift and Nathan Chapman. So you also got track guys like Nathan Chapman, got Ross Copperman, Luke Layer that works with Casey Musgraves, Zach Crowell that works with Sam Hunt, it's Chris DeStefano that works with a ton of people, but Carrie Underwood would be probably a bigger name. These guys are so talented. And in the advent of digital coming into the Forum Nashville, these guys could play all the instruments on a record that used to require a session band. And as budgets got smaller with labels selling less records, they relied more on the ability of these track guys to be able to play a lot of these instruments and save budget costs. And a lot of times what's amazing, like for instance, Shane McNally, who's in the book as well, and Luke Layard produced Casey Musgrave's first two records with her. A lot of what you hear on the radio are those demos. Isn't that crazy? Like Ross Copperman and Dierks Bentley, that amazing song Black, that was made at Ross's studio. And the day they wrote it, that's the final track. Some mixing on it. But you know what I'm saying? It's amazing to me that this gold mine of talent was not being chronicled in a sort of fundamental way in a book. And so I was so lucky. There's 30 writers in total, or 30 producers in total, in this book. It's 600 pages long. If you're a country music fan and all you're interested in is that one chapter about, or two chapters about a couple artists, go for it. They're in here. And you can read about every hit they made, and you can listen along while you read. And if you don't want to read, there's two audiobooks, Blackstone Audio, or Audible, Blackstone, I read for audiobooks, put out a volume 1 and 2 of this because it was like 50 hours. You can also go to YouTube, and there's over 100 videos with producers from the book that we filmed telling these stories. So we tried to create a multitude of formats for people to absorb these stories in, whether it was the book format or audiobook or video or whatever we could do.
Well, Jake, if you are a music fan, period, you're going to love this book.
Thank you.
And like you said, you can dig into a chapter and if you're looking for a certain producer or that has worked with an artist that intrigued you, I promise if you'll read through, you'll find other stuff that just captures your imagination. Jake, I'm recommending this book to everyone.
Oh, thank you.
Right now, it is amazing. If people are just learning about you and want to dig into all the great stuff that you do, where can they find you online?
I will put this into one elevator speech answer that also mentions some upcoming books I'm doing. JakeBrownBooks.com. You can get everything at Amazon. There's National Songwriter 3 is coming out next year. Beyond the Beats, Volume 2. Volume 1 had all the great rock, metal and rock drummers, Metallica, Guns N' Roses, Motley, Journey, Creedence Clearwater, Bon Jovi, Foo Fighters, Jane's Addiction, Red Hot Chili Peppers, etc. Volume 2 and 3 have 30 more drummers, Clash, The Police, Iron Maiden, anyone you want. There's also Teddy Riley's memoirs coming up next year. Remember the Times, we've been working on that 7 years. I'm also writing a book with my summer camp. I think I might be the first authorized book on a summer camp, interviewing all the campers. I went there 6 years, was open 25 years. It's called 40 Legends. There's just a variety of things. I think a really important National Songwriter 3 is coming up next year. I think an important key to continuing to have a career as a writer, especially in this day and age, is to be as working all the time, work on 3 or 4 books at once. You can work one day on one day on another, constantly be interviewing people and seeking interviews with people, because that's really the bread and butter of your books. Anyone can write narrative. Really also, like, in the long run, if I could just really quickly in closing dispense two pieces of advice to new writers, make sure that you surround yourself with really good people. And remember that if you're thinking, gosh, I'm going to have to spend money on a lawyer or on a commission, you know, for an agent or whatever, you're going to spend a lot more in the long run and the money you lose if you don't be, you know, it's a team player game. And also, you know, really, really make sure that you're always, always taking any gig that comes your way, whether it is a fiction book that you didn't necessarily want to write, but you know, you maybe could because you were a fiction writer, but the agent brought you another kind of type of genre. Or if you're a nonfiction, take on whatever you can get when you're early, because then you'll be 20 years later sitting here still doing it. And I consider every new book I have like only as relevant as that book. I mean, I really fight very hard to keep my name out there because there's always these amazing, talented people ready to take your place if you don't, you know.
Absolutely.
Thanks again for having me on. I appreciate
absolutely,
it.
Jake. Behind the Boards Nashville is Behind the Boards Nashville, the studio stories behind country music's greatest hits. You don't have to be a country music fan. If you're a fan of music in general, you're going to love this book. Jake, we're going to send people to visit you at your website and to pick up this book as well. There's links to both of those in the show notes. Please come back again and let's talk music some more.
I will. And if we do, if you can include this too, Freddie Powers, Spree of 83, that book had Merle Haggard and Willie Nelson, and it's presently being turned into a film. Screenplay's done. We're kind of casting it now. So hopefully when next time we talk, maybe that'll be in production. So yeah, absolutely. It'd be an honor to come back, and it was an honor to be on. I appreciate it.
Absolutely.
Scribophile is a respectful online writing workshop and writers community. Writers of all skill levels join to improve each other's work with thoughtful critiques and by sharing their writing experiences. We're the writing group to join if you want to find beta readers, get the best feedback around, learn how to get published, and be a part of the friendliest and most successful writing workshop online. Improve your writing by receiving detailed critiques. Learn from a vast collection of free writing resources. Make lifelong friends in our busy community of writers. Writing is a solitary art, but that doesn't mean you have to be lonely. Lucky for you, there are thousands of writers on Scribophile every day, and we're a really friendly bunch. You've never seen a writing group like this one? Join Scribophile today at scribophile.community.